Hey guys, don't forget the 2023 Street Cop Training Conference, Nashville, Tennessee, April 23rd through the 28th. You do not want to miss this. So far, guest speakers, Rob O'Neill, the Navy SEAL that was responsible for killing Osama bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, U.S. Marine, Medal of Honor recipient, jumping on an IED to protect his platoon. Fox News host Tommy Lahren returns for 2023. Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff Mark Lamb, Sheriff David Clark, and more to come. You don't want to miss this event. We additionally have 20 of the country's top law enforcement educators giving you the best experience of your life. You will leave this event knowing more about your job and how to be proficient at the things you do, hands down, any other event that you'll ever attend. I personally guarantee it. Don't miss out. There's a room code at streetcop.com for our room block and room code at the Gaylord at Opry is where the event's taking place. Don't miss out on a discounted rate. The rate is from Sunday to Thursday. Put that in and find yourselves at a half-price room. Split it with a friend, but make sure you get there. You don't want to miss this event. It is going to be that good. If you trust me and you trust Street Cop, trust that you will leave there feeling like you've had an experience of a lifetime.
You trying to be a street cop?
We left off last time talking about use of force. We're going to go use of force, right?
Use force and training. Yeah. And kind of the changes there and what we're doing. Dan, I see some clear change from even the late 90s and what we're doing. And I see some good things. So,
you know, it's funny. The first thing we talk about is use of force and training is the topic for today's podcast. And the first thing that comes to my mind is recently, and I'm going to try to keep this as vague as possible. I knew somebody who was very close to me who went to a police academy. It was brought to my attention that this is the first time in 21 years that this agency had actually taken an opportunity to look at their use of force policy, their defensive tactics policy, and actually update it. So for 21 years, the curriculum was the curriculum. 21 years. Nobody took a look at this thing. And it's no different than people being tasked the duty of going into their SOPs and reviewing them. I have friends of mine that are really good at case law. And they're like, dude, I literally went in and found 27 SOPs that are violations of the Fourth Amendment. So you would follow our SOP, but violate completely the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, according to what they want you to do. And it came down to bad policy writers or nobody reviewing these things. And it's wild, right?
Yeah. So let's talk about that for a minute. When I talk to departments, where they get into problems is, number one, this disconnect between DTs and even use force. Like, how am I going to handle a tactics? How am I going to handle a stop? How am I going to handle whether or not we're going to go in this house or not? When that stuff gets sectioned out and there's no continuity, you're not controlling that under one roof, at least having your use of force guys, your DT guys should know use of force. And by that, I mean case law. And they should know case law on search and seizure. And they should know case law on all those things. And those should get intertwined when you provide agency training. That's one thing that'll help alleviate that. The second thing that'll help alleviate that is departments will then go to DTs and they'll get this DT guy and he doesn't have a lot of background and he doesn't have skill sets. If it were the private sector, wasn't a public police agency, he probably would not be able to coach. He doesn't have a varied skill set. He's not well-rounded. He can't wrestle, get off the ground well, defend punches, take people down, control other humans. He doesn't have any of those skill sets. And so what we do with our DT manuals, we say, well, you're going to do this technique, this technique, this technique, this technique. These are approved. Instead of saying, this is what case law says generally about what you can and can't do. And that needs to be in our training all the time, all the time. You should know force options. You should know resistance levels of suspects. You should understand case law. That's got to be in the defensive tactics hands-on training. And then the second thing is, just like we shouldn't paint ourselves, that's how policy stays for 21 years, is we say it's this move, this move, this move. Instead of, it's based on these general premises and outcomes we want to achieve. And so DT-wise, we got to do the same thing and say, anything you do, there's nothing approved and nothing not approved. What approves a use of force are the facts and circumstances known to the officer, their reasonable perception of what those things mean, and then their understanding of case law and what they can and can't do. That's what validates or invalidates any seizure, stop, use of force, hands-on. And so those things have to be cohesive.
In your opinion, what does the current state of training at police academies look like in comparison to what they should get?
In my opinion, there's too much. We're going to have this tactic, and not enough skill set development and general knowledge development so that you produce a living, breathing, thinking problem solver. You don't hand feed them, oh, there's the answer to this problem. There's the answer to this problem. If he does A, you do B. What you do is you feed them a context of overall principles, concepts, and then case law and desired outcomes for the agency. And then with that, you're developing guys who think through and solve problems. That would be a big help on the police academy end.
What's your thoughts on people who are enrolled into a police academy at the recruit level or cadet level, whatever you want to call it, when they're being constantly conditioned to take a stick out, swing it at a bag that their friend's holding and scream, get back for, I don't know, 15 or 20 sessions. What's your thoughts on that?
It doesn't produce problem solvers. It doesn't produce people with varied skill sets. It doesn't produce, it's not relative to any live event. I think it's bad. I think it's a waste of time. You'd be better spent developing skill sets like, can I go hands-on and actually hit takedowns, defend takedowns? Even that should be in a principle and concept-based manner. Instead of running 5 miles, do some kind of, you don't have to do CrossFit because sometimes CrossFit gets crazy, but some kind of body weight. I'm moving my own body. I'm moving someone else's body. Wrestling, jujitsu, light sparring, and then instituting into those training sessions, hey, when will we use this? When might it apply that I'm going to get a 2-on-1 armbar? What kind of situation could you think of on a call? What kind of stop and what kind of resistance, what kind of knowledge would I have to actually punch somebody? To stand around and punch bags and yell stuff and stomp in unison is nonsense and doesn't produce anything lasting.
You know, I have constantly said over and over again, we are spending far too much time on things that don't matter. And you're sending these guys out and girls out for complete failure. But as you said, it body drags, right? So like, why are we not training our men and women at the cadet or recruit level to set up a scenario, mats down, whatever you want to do. And they are a wounded body. Yeah. Teaching these guys to grab and work together, 2-man teams, 3-man teams, 4-man teams. And that's your conditioning, right? Go next group. Run up, grab the body, go. You're the next body. Go out, you know, like whatever.
It's a great way. So what I look for is fight functional movements. And I call them fight functional. We could probably come up with a better word for police training. But I come up with fight functional movements for warm-up, for conditioning, for everything, so that I'm just becoming comfortable grabbing another human, leaning on them, them leaning on me, them pushing against me, me pushing back. I can go to a call here in Vegas with 2 or 3 of our young guys. And I'm well known on the agency at this point. If Vegas Metro is a very large agency, but if you met a guy from Vegas Metro and asked them if they know me, they probably do. I've been here a long time and done a couple things. So with that being said, I'll go on a call and I'll have these young guys. They look great. They have their tailored shirt, their CrossFit Water of the Day score. They know it. They can quote it to you. But when I get to them, they're all out of breath. Their shirt's untucked. Their radio's over here. I say, hey, what happened? Oh, the guy resisted. And I look over at the guy and it's like some homeless guy with open sores and he lives behind the dumpster. And I say, well, yeah, then what happened? And they say, well, it must be the meth. He's just super strong. And it's not that he's strong. It's that they're not doing fight functional training where they're not used to another human pushing against them. So if that same guy would have pushed on old man Chad, who's not very big, I'm 5'8", I'm 180 pounds, I'm 54 years old. If he would have pushed on me, he wouldn't have pushed me around the room and he would have thought I was very strong because I understand leverage, I understand connection, I understand what it feels like to be pushed and I can push back or change my angle. All that's institutional knowledge in my head, which is what cops use most of the time. What cops use most of the time is their two hands. First, your mouth and your mind. Most important DT weapons. My ability to communicate, with the suspect and be clear in my intention with them and be clear in my communication with them. That's the first step of DTs. You're outstanding if you can communicate well with other humans. Your body language is a big part of your communication. It's more likely to be on point if you've done some of the training you just mentioned. Something job specific. I don't care about your bench press numbers. Can you drag Dennis from point A to point B under stress? That's trained. So those things start to come out on calls where the bad guy recognizes someone who's got hours and hours of doing this and someone who does not. Someone who went through a recert on a bag yelling some slogan. Two hugely different things. I'll give you one more example if I could. We were at the gym the other day, 6'7", 280-pound guy I've known for over 20 years. He's one of my black belts in jiu-jitsu. He's 6'7", 280 pounds. He's not fat. He was military for over 20 years. He now does close protection work here in the Vegas Valley. Very accomplished military person, very accomplished athlete, but now older. He hurts both knees rolling. They both pop. He's down. He's like, Chad, I can't get up. Like he drags himself to the side where he's leaning against the wall on a matted area. It's at a private jiu-jitsu gym. It was a jiu-jitsu class. It's an Extreme Couture MMA here in Vegas. He physically can't stand up. Now he's 6'7", 280, and he's big. I've got two guys in the class who also work for PFC training, and they understand carries, to your point. So we've got Dustin's down, and I've got a couple other guys from the company who understand carries for wounded officers. We literally get this guy out of the gym, loaded into a vehicle to the ER to be checked out through buddy carries that we've trained for law enforcement.
Comfortably.
Yeah, comfortably. And we said, hey, this is a carry we're going to try. Dust says that won't work. You're going to put weight on my legs. He knows the carries. We go, okay, Dust, we're going to do this partner carry. He goes, okay, that would work. And we literally say, okay, we're going to execute this partner carry. And we execute a partner carry on a downed guy outside of work because we've actually practiced that. And so we're able to move this 6'7", 280 guy, 280-pound guy with none of us weighing over 200 pounds. And we just scoop him up, walk out of the gym with him. And everybody at the gym, all the fighters and stuff are like, holy crap, look at Coach. And it's a comfortable carry because we've trained it.
I went to three police academies over the course of about 4.5 to 5 years. And not one of those police academies trained us in body carries. But I will tell you what I did learn. I really knew how to march good.
Oh, yeah.
That was an important skill that I needed to have because I was never going to march ever again in my life. And we spent a lot of time on drill and parade. Oh, yeah. So I make this joke in class. It's like, you know, you really start to unpack this stuff and you try to leave from tradition. And I get there's got to be some, I like the idea of there being some bearing in some sense of having some discipline. And I'll be honest with you, in the first police academy, the way that I was pushed to my limits, we have tough academies out here. You know, I learned a lot about myself through that, which was really good. But as far as practical skill knowledge or physical skill knowledge, nothing of the sort. And that brings me to my next small excerpt, and I'd like to get your opinion on it. I remember being in my first police academy and saying to the defensive tactic instructor who was showing us clavicle pulls and like wrist grabs and like goosenecks and like doing this thing where you take your knuckle and put it in somebody's ear and like twisting it like this, or like going behind somebody's thigh and pinching that fatty part of the thigh to get compliance. What's your thoughts on that bullshit? Cause I asked him, and I guess I was bold as a recruit. I was 19, 20 years old. And I said, does this stuff actually work? And he said, well, it depends if you know how to use it. I go, I know, but we're here in a police academy learning how to use it. Are you telling me I'm going to leave here and do a clavicle pull on somebody, take my hook, my finger and drag them down? And he even kind of like gave me that look like, yeah, no, none of this stuff's going to work.
Yeah, no, it doesn't work. It's nonsense. They know it's nonsense. But here's the problem. Like when I have this conversation with an agency and I'm consulting with them and I'm consulting with their training staff, there's fiefdoms and kingdoms, and they're in control of that. And I have to be, I want to be productive in my conversation. I don't just want them to shut down and go, oh, this guy's a jerk. And he's just saying it doesn't work because it's not what he does. And so I'll often frame it and I'll say, okay, if I did it to you, would you stop fighting if you needed to fight? Would any of these things disable or control you? Well, no, it wouldn't control me. Oh, so me pinching the skin behind your leg, you would ignore that if we're in a physical confrontation. Yeah, I would. Who's going to not ignore that? Well, I guess someone who's mentally weak. Okay, so someone who's not committed might respond favorably to that. Yeah, what if I'm committed? Yeah, you're not going to respond favorably to that at all. Okay, well, I'm only training for the committed guys. I shouldn't be pinching the ones who aren't committed. So let's focus on tactics that give me a greater amount of control. And that's going to be, am I in a dominant position? Because even if I get control of you, it doesn't guarantee you'll stop fighting. You could be in handcuffs and still fight somewhat effectively and possibly injure somebody. I might need to control you even more and hobble you, depending on what the department policy says and the equipment we're given. You could still fight even as we start to apply restraints to you. So I have to have a methodology that doesn't count on a clavicle push or a pressure point or a pinch. I've got to have a defensive tactic system that puts me and a police officer in a position of advantage. And a position of advantage means I'm in a dominant spot where I could do multiple things to the suspect, to include disengagement, to include going to a weapon system, to include strikes if authorized and needed, to include control holds, to include all those things. So once I'm in a spot where I can do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things, and the bad guy's main thing he's going to have to do is escape this inferior position to be effective. He's going to have to reverse the tables on me. He's going to have to get out of this spot he's in where I have so many options that all of them could be selected at any one time. And I might try an option. It might not work. Well, then I can do a different option. That might not work. Ultimately, I might just choose to disengage because this guy is a badass and he's staying in the fight despite me being in a dominant spot. So now maybe I make space, go to a tool, get more friends there. Can I get on the radio? Am I in a controlled enough spot I can talk on the radio and get more units rolling to me? So your DTs need to focus on winning positionally so that whether the officer is better physically or not, they're still in a better position than the bad guy. And so then they start going, okay, well, that makes sense. And they start understanding, I'm not an adversary. I want us all to be better and safer. But we can't do that if we're not honest about, is this going to work? It's not going to work. Okay, well, let's throw it out then. Let's stop doing it today. We've done it one day too long. So let's just throw that away and let's start focusing on things that let us accomplish our lawful objective. And the lawful objective of force on a suspect is control to custody. That's what I'm looking for. So if your silly pressure point thing doesn't induce physical control over this, if you're saying the only way I'll gain control is with cooperation or compliance, then it's not a good tactic. It's a poor tactic. And it's likely to fail against the very people I need it to work for, which are the people who are going to be committed to hurt me or other people. So it's nonsense. And when I start to break it down that way, they feel less attacked. And I tell them, by the way, if you show me something that gives me more control, I'm going to buy into it and I'm actually going to steal it. I'll credit you, but I'm going to go teach it to everybody because I'm not the smartest guy. I'm still learning. I know up to this point, this much stuff. I'm convinced it could be done better. I'm convinced someone's doing better than Chad. I'm convinced I don't know everything. But in that journey, I'm willing to say, I used to do this. It's not as good as this. I'm going to change and do this thing over here now. I'm not going to hold on to something because it has my name on it.
People are romantic with the past and the way things were and how things were for them. And
how good they were. You know, I was the best ever. Okay, whatever. Then you weren't in the right room.
Correct.
If you're not going with savages, with dudes who are your equal or better, then you're failing. If you're going to be the instructor, I'm going to be the guy who's going to share this great material. You better be unafraid of being a student yourself and being called out on your own stuff that doesn't work and needs to be improved on. Otherwise, don't be that guy.
Could you take some of the silly shit that we do in the academies? And I'll even say there's actually in-service training for the, when, you know, the one guy who's going to work for a couple of weeks as the red man. And like, you know, you're going to deliver these foam baton strikes to his knees and he's pretend like he's hurt. You did your job. Right. I look at some of this stuff and I'm just like, oh, it's so silly. And, you know, and usually, Chad, it's typically, for the most part, what I've seen in the past, taught by people who don't even get in fights.
Yeah.
We had guys at our agency that I don't never heard of them getting involved physically with anybody ever in my career. Administrators who were teaching this stuff, and they don't have reputations like that guy was a road dog. This guy was, you know, when shit hit the fan, is the guy you wanted to show up. And we'd have some of us and the guys who you did want to show up, we'd be laughing at the, like, what are we doing here with this dumb belt on, with this styrofoam, like Velcro fucking stick that we're pretending to hit this guy with? And like, yeah, it's just so, and then they bring these dainty little humans out that work with us. And they're like, you know, get back. And like the guy pretends to fall. It's like just the most ridiculous I've ever seen. But with that lead in, could you take that stuff away out of the academy that's not working in your opinion and your professional opinion and replace it with maybe an objective of we're going to try to get to 5 or 6 moves that by the time you leave this academy, you should be comfortable and there should be muscle memory with it. And these are 90% of the scenarios that we think you're going to be in physically. These 5 to 6 moves or these techniques can significantly increase the likelihood of you gaining control of this situation.
Yes. And instead of 5 to 6 moves, what we focus on is 5 to 6 principles or positions. I'll explain to you what I mean. Whenever we teach anything to an agency, we say, okay, we've got 4 overriding general principles of being a cop and being in a combative situation that we want the folks we train with to learn. And the number one thing is, well, they're not necessarily in order, but they're the big 4 principles or objectives. Number one is I want to try to stay mobile. So if I become immobile as the officer, I'm pinned against a wall. I'm underneath somebody. I'm on bottom position. Your sole purpose should be to become more mobile and to get up or get in a position where you can move, to include disengagement. That also counts when I'm on top. So when I'm on top, instead of, for example, laying on someone and getting a half guard, which is a jiu-jitsu move, where I grab one of your legs with 2 of my legs to try to kill your movement. Instead of going half guard, which also immobilizes Chad, I'm going to go and put my knee on top of you if you're belly up and my hands on you, so that at any point I can just stand up and get away from you if I don't want to be there anymore. So mobility. I'm seeking mobility always in a defensive encounter. That doesn't mean I won't go to the ground, because if I restrict your mobility as a suspect, I'm also winning. So make Chad more mobile, make bad guy less mobile. That's a concept, an idea. I don't care how Dennis accomplishes that. You could accomplish that through your high school wrestling if you have that background. You could accomplish that through jiu-jitsu. You could accomplish that through, certainly we're going to teach techniques, but the techniques are going to be less important than the objective or the goal. The second objective that we try to teach cops is think transition. If one thing's not working, do something else. Don't get stuck on one technique. This is why we don't teach 5 techniques and just focus on these 5s, because what we see guys do is they go, okay, well, this is my technique. I got to make this work. It's failing, but I'm going to hang in there and try to make this work because I don't have the goal is the technique. For us, that's not the goal. The goal for us is body positioning and our ability to put a suspect on the ground and us on top. That's the main objective we're working for. So look at transitioning. If one thing's not working, go to something else. That's another thing we teach our cops. Third thing we teach our cops is manage distance, manage damage. I'm either going to be outside the reach, you can physically punch me in the face, or I'm going to be inside here, but I'm never here where we both can exchange. I don't stay here. I live here where I'm outside your reach, or I live right on top of you. Now, if I choose right on top of you, our last main principle is I create an angle. If this is two human beings, one human facing the other human, not face to face. So our last objective or principle we try to beat home into our guys is if you end up nose to nose, you and I are looking at each other and we're fighting, I need to get to a point where I'm looking in your ear, I'm looking at the back of your head with mobility. I need to move. So if we come together, I'm sliding to these angles and trying to create an angle. Anytime I create an angle, my hips face you, your hips face away, I'm winning that encounter. When your hips face away from me, your ability to attack me has decreased significantly. When you're looking at me, you've got one hand, two hands, both knees, both feet. You could grab me. You could headbutt me. Once I start sliding to your angle, now you're limited in your attack. Your best defense is just to fix the angle. So those four things are things we focus on. So every time we teach a technique, we say what principles are at work in this technique so that the student begins to learn principles and concepts as opposed to moves. Because even if I teach five moves, how many times do you have to rep the move to get good at it? Well, it depends on what book you read. It's going to be in the hundreds or thousands. But if I can teach you concepts and you understand conceptually distance, I need to be in or out. Well, you can learn that in a training session. You could certainly learn that over the basis of an academy. And so in or out comes first. The move when we're in comes second. And if you don't like what's going on when you're in, then get out. Okay. The other thing we teach our cops is on your bad guy, you want to affect their posture. What is posture? It's where my head is. My head's forward, my head's back, my head's side to side. If my head, shoulders, hips, knees, toes are in alignment, I'm athletic and strong. If you can make me bend forward or rear of my hips with my head, and I don't care how you do that. You could just push on the head. So break the suspect's posture. Second one, break their structure. In other words, get inside position. Control an arm with a two-on-one. Control your subject, one of your subject's body parts, and use that to manipulate them. And then the third thing is attack their base. Pick one leg up off the ground so they tip over. Put their feet all the way together. Put their feet far apart. That's what we do when we set someone up. We break their power base. So breaking their power base, one of our core principles as well. So when we teach anything, takedowns, takedown defense, punches, punch defense, baton strikes, control, we go off those seven principles. The big four being try to be mobile, try to transit, think of transitions that you might need to do, control distance, create angles, attack their posture, their structure, their base. If a cop can learn those things and do those things, they're going to win the majority of their fights.
Interesting question I have for you, but what's the optimal overall goal of when we engage with a suspect or your intention for the outcome when you teach your training programs? What's the overall goal? And I, you know, for me, I'm just going to tell you mine. I'm sure it's probably close to the same thing, is like to ensure that the situation is resolved with the least amount of injury to suspect and police officer.
Yeah. And police officer first. And then right. Secondly, absolutely. That's a great goal. I think it's best practice. I think anybody who's teaching, I love it. Yeah, that would be it. And then how do we do that, though, from a defensive tactics world with that goal in mind? What I try to teach my cops is win position first. Win dominant positions. Learn how to escape inferior positions. And we teach that. And then you get to dominant positions where you can achieve that goal. You're not going to achieve that goal if both guys are nose to nose in a free for all.
When you said earlier force options, let's talk about that a little bit. When we say force options, my first thought goes to, you know, the use of force continuum. How does that correlate with what our force options are? Maybe, you know, people who aren't police officers can imagine that the amount of people that are subscribed to this podcast are all cops. It's over 400,000 subscribers.
Sure. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Frankie does it all. He's here on the board right behind me well, right
Frank
now.
Frank has done an amazing job. That dude is.
Yeah, I owe it all to Frank. Yeah,
that's well, it. He's a stud. He makes it easy on my end, I'll tell you.
Yeah, yeah. Frank is well received and welcomed here almost immediately. It's a nice occasion when somebody gets hired here and they flow seamlessly right into the whole flow of the whole office. Like,
so when we talk force options for us, Dennis, and then maybe you can piggyback on the back end of this, because actually I respect one of the things I really love about you and what you do is you do a very good job of encouraging guys to gain knowledge and then use that knowledge to solve problems. That's one of the things that I actually, I'm actually a fan and follow you because you do that well. And so when I think in terms of force options, what I'm thinking of is options, general broad strokes that the officer might have available to him based on the subject's resistance. So I think continuum, when I started in the late 90s, continuum kind of meant back then when I first went to my first police academy was, hey, if the subject does this, now I do this. If they do this, now I do this. If they do this, now I do this. And we're going almost on this ladder and we're walking up this ladder and you can't skip rungs and we're going to go in this order, if you will. I think a more modern approach is talking about subject resistance level and then force options available to the officer in broad strokes, meaning I don't have to go through officer presence, verbal commands, try an empty hand technique. Oh, now I'm going to try a low lethality tool. Oh, now I'm finally escalating to lethal force. It means as soon as I make my assessment of my subject's behavior, my bad guy's behavior, what the threat level is, reasonable threat level, my Graham v. Connor factors, and factoring any additional factors that different circuit courts over the years have kind of put out there for us to consider. Well, I'm analyzing and assessing that even from the point I get the call to I'm en route, I'm pre-planning in my head, I'm going through potential scenarios, I'm reviewing maybe training things that I've had or what I understand the call to be. I arrive at the call, I get out of my car, I start to observe and assess what's going on. Maybe I see nothing initially, I make my approach. And now as I come into the actual physical call, I've got those pre-factors that I was acting on, and maybe it's changed dramatically, but I'm assessing subject behavior, suspect behavior, and what they're doing. Well, now I'm starting to think of force options available to me as a police officer. So it's a broad category. I could be in low-level force, option-wise, which would mean my subject was maybe in obstructive resistance or not showing a clear intent to harm, but they weren't cooperative. So my low-level options might be verbal commands, my actual presence, my identifying myself as a police officer, my giving lawful commands to control the movement of the subject. All those things might be low-level options up to hand, open hand, empty hand, control-type holds, which may escalate into a takedown or a control hold or maybe even handcuffing to restrain the subject. Those are all force options on that low-level spectrum. These are force options that are not likely to produce injury or death, and they're likely to simply be a low-level force option. Intermediate force options might happen when a subject is assaultive. I can articulate reasonably that through their behavior, through their body language, through their words, through their physical actions, they're going to attempt some kind of assaultive behavior that could reasonably result in injury to myself or someone else. Well, when I think of force options for that assaultive person, I still could do the control type stuff, depending on if I can get a dominant position and immediately take them down. But I also might mix in empty hand strikes, maybe a deployment of a baton, pepper spray, a taser, depending on their assaultive behavior. I might even be able to articulate some kind of low lethality projectile, like a beanbag application, something like that. Then we move into the subject's behavior being life-threatening, or their resistance is life-threatening. It's likely to cause death or substantial harm or serious injury. And I can articulate that reasonably. Typically, they're armed with a weapon system and they're showing an intent to do harm through either their actions or their verbals. This could also occur with an empty hand subject where they rise to that lethality realm if they're attempting to disarm me and arm themselves. That can also make them go from a assaultive individual to a life-threatening. Once we reach that life-threatening level, well, now our force options are lethal in nature. That could be application of a handgun. That could be a bladed exchange. That could even be an application of an intermediate tool like a baton, but now it becomes life-threatening. The guy arms himself with a knife. We're at close quarters. I can't make space. He's pursuing me, and now I hit him in the head with the baton. So I could use an intermediate tool in a lethal manner as well, force option-wise. So when I speak of force options, I'm thinking of the officer getting training that gives him various skill sets, or her. And the most important training we can give when we even talk about force options is having the officer win positionally. If you can win positionally, meaning I'm on top, they're on bottom, and also if I can get their face to the ground or their belly down and I'm on top, it dramatically reduces their effectiveness in a fight. So everything I'm doing, even empty hand, is trying to lead me to that dominant spot where I may need to, where I could potentially keep my force options on the lower end, even if the subject is trying to resist in an assaultive manner, but I'm controlling them. Well, now I can still stay in that low-level application of force. I've got control. I can go to custody. If they still fight after being handcuffed, I could apply further restraint, such as a hobble, something like that. If they're spitting or biting, maybe a spit mask. I can just continue to control them and apply additional restraint procedures to watch for my safety first. And then if I'm safe, then they're safe. And we can have that synergy that happens.
You know, often I see videos of police officers who are going, you know, essentially what appears to me, they rely on mechanical force. And I'm going to pack this on more. I travel around the country a lot. And I often look at people who are clearly not in good physical condition. And it seems like to me, I look at those people and I say, whether it's on one extreme or the other of poor physical condition, which I mean, they're, you know, they, it's just clear as day. Maybe just if I had to guess, they're probably not that good physically in a scenario, a situation. I just, maybe I'm wrong, but I would assume that most of the people, maybe I'm wrong for that assumption, but I see these videos, you see them, these people deploying contact stun tasers. Now, I will also preface this by saying, I'm not a use force expert, you are. I think a taser is a great tool. I was amazed when it first came out and they started really getting deployed. I remember getting demonstrated, and when they're effective, I mean, they are good, right? Like, it's a great friggin' tool. I caution by saying when they are effective, because Taser, which I'm certainly supporting their company and their, I believe in the product 100%, will also acknowledge that it's not always going to work, but it's an option, right? So what do you say to somebody who is saying to themselves, well, I don't need to fight. I've got tools on my belt that will help me.
So yeah, you often have the guy who will say, towards me, they'll say, well, Chad, you're a ninja or you're a UFC fighter, which I'm not. They'll give me more credit than I deserve. But they'll say, I'm a gun guy, or I'm a tool guy, to your point. At Vegas Metro, 1 year in in-service training for a calendar year, we asked the group, we said, okay, raise your hands. What we did is an informal pool, very unscientific. But the guy who says that to me, I'll say, okay, well, how many tasings do you have in the course of your career then? Over the course of your career, how many times have you actually tased somebody? Most cops in modern days right now, if they're in a decent department that's pretty busy, are going to be somewhere in the 2 to 5 range. I've got 2 to 5 taser applications in my career. And I'll say, okay, well, how many times have you hit somebody with a baton? In modern times, with the batons we get now, almost nobody. Those are door knockers. That's to knock
back
on
scratchers, bottle retrievers.
Nobody's using those to hit people.
Wait, my favorite one. So we used to do this all the time. My favorite one is the, some guy said, when I can't reach the call button at the Sally port, I deploy my baton and press the white button on the little call box.
That's it. Exactly. So baton, it's rare to have a modern officer in patrol with a collapsible baton have 2 or more applications. It almost never happens where they say, baton is my force option choice. I'm going to snap it out. Now I'm going to go to work with my baton. Almost never happens.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think that is?
Outside of crowd control situations. Well, two reasons. Number one is we're not, this is the whole point of this exercise. Then I ask about pepper spray. It's almost the same thing. And then I ask about firearm applications, and two or more is a lot. If you've actually pulled the trigger, I've been a shooter two or more times. You're generally on a team of some sort and you're being thrown into that situation repeatedly. If you're a patrol guy and you have two or more shootings, pretty rare guy. So now your question, why do I think that is? Number one is, I think that the collapsible batons, the ones that we get issued, are not reliable and they don't work really well. So you're hitting a guy multiple times and under adrenaline, it's not effective. It doesn't work like in training where the person magically falls over like you did something. I think that that's number one problem. But the second problem, so deployment and use of the tool does not reinforce the fact that it would be a good force option. Having said that, though, most people never deploy it. And the reason I think that is, and this is what we did in Vegas, is we said, we went around the belt for all the low lethality and lethal options a cop carries. And we said, how many times have you deployed it? And nobody on my agency, and Vegas is a very busy agency, we have a lot of applications of force. Nobody said, oh, I've got three or more shootings. I got three or more deployments of pepper. I got three or more times I've hit somebody with my baton, and I got three or more tasings. Nobody had three or more of all of it. Okay. Everyone had some deployment, but a lot of people didn't have any pepper spraying. They didn't have any baton deployments. It was either taser or a firearm in their whole career. Right. And so what we said to them is, now raise your hand if you've ever had to struggle with somebody three or more times in your career. Guess how many hands went up?
Everybody. Yeah. Everybody.
Everybody. And so what we told our guys is, it's false that you're a gun guy or a tool guy. If you were, you would be doing it every week. The truth is, you're a talking person, you're a thinking person, and you're an empty hand person. So the most important skill sets you could build are going to be your ability to communicate, your knowledge of policy and law and how to apply it on an actual freaking call, and your empty hand skill sets. You've got to become an expert in those areas. And if you become an expert in those areas, you're rarely going to need the tools on your belt. Occasionally you are. Occasionally you're going to have to pull the trigger. And we sign up for that when that time comes. But that time's not going to come very often if you actually work on those other skill sets.
Talked about having an increased use of your firearm if you were on some kind of detail or team that's very proactive. You know, you actually triggered something that people know about me. There was a report, and you know, I was named as in the agency as having the most use of force reports in place. Sure. It didn't say use of force complaints. It didn't say use of force reviews, and it was just the most times of use of force. So people would say, "How did you end up with so many use of force reports?" I said, "Well, let's think about this a little bit. First of all, I worked at that time 4 p.m. to 2 a.m. shift, the busiest shift at a significantly sized agency, where sometimes we would be one low on manpower. Essentially, that didn't happen that often, but you guys got to understand something. We had 15 guys on the road. Because of my performance previously on other occasions that people have seen, they are aware that I am one of those people who that you can call upon when you need things to happen or it's dangerous physically. Matter of fact, I would be called off my times. I'd get calls from the so we had a cop that dispatched and like five pods of dispatchers that would feed them the jobs, which was very, very smart. If you have the right motivated cop, I'm still a big fan of that. You have the right guy on the radio. I think that's very important. That's just me versus a civilian. I'm not saying a civilian doesn't do a good job. We had great civilian dispatchers. They had to take over at times, but rarely. So we had one of our coworkers. What was good about that is our coworkers knew our strengths and weaknesses. It was just not somebody who was taking guesses at who they had in the patrol. They've seen them in the field and how they perform. So guess what happened to Dennis all the time? Well, I'd be on a accident job, right? I got the paperwork, you know, headquarters to car 5. Good. You got everything you need over there for that report? Yeah. All right. I got six guys duking it out in the parking lot of this bar, right? You and who else? The other dude or two dudes on the shift at the 15 on the road, right? Other people are going to come and help, but a lot of times it wasn't even my job. It's just that they're sending me as backup. So I'm getting sent to fight calls and hot domestics. They are clearing me from other jobs. They're reassigning other jobs to get me to the more dangerous shit. You know, so nothing, there was no situation where I felt the force that I had to use was ever unauthorized or not called for. As a matter of fact, the guys that went, the big dudes, were the guys you wanted to go because they were the last guys trying to fucking fight you. We would try to talk to you at first. But also at the same time, if we couldn't talk to you, we were not the guys you wanted there as the perp. Because you're not going to win. Thank God that I was in a position that I never lost. And I think about that sometimes. I'm like, man, I'm glad that I've never, you know, because the loss in this game is significant. It could be very detrimental. Yeah. But I put a lot of thought into, although I was not training mixed martial arts, I put a lot of thought constantly into, one, what I looked like when I came to work. Because a lot of times people would see me and say, eh, I'm, they would certainly look at somebody versus me and say, I don't want to go there with this guy. That guy, I'm looking at that guy right there. I'm saying, this is the guy that I want. I'm going to give him more of a hard time. Two, I was in quintessential better shape than most people. Not that I was some specimen, because I also had a little bit of a drinking problem at the time. I would say a partying problem as well. But I still would get to the gym and get what I was a significant gym guy. And I think I was selected for things, to be quite honest with you, even before people knew my, just on the way that I looked, I was selected my previous job to be on a civilian disturbance unit. Like, why did I get chosen? Well, I looked around and I realized they looked at me and said, this guy works out. He's got big arms. And this is a serious unit where we're going to be getting physical with people, you know? And at that time, there was no, like, this was riot crowd control and it was real. And it wasn't like, you're, hey, let me get your, after you swing a stick at a guy, let me get your name. No, we're in shit hits the fan mode. We're swinging sticks. Yeah. We're deploying tear gas. We're deploying, you know, fire extinguisher size pepper spray canisters. And that's what our job is. It's not like, hey, write a report on what you did. There was no report. What I did was make sure nobody else got their fucking ass kicked. Right. And like, and we dissolved this situation immediately. So that was a long time ago. It's 20 years ago, right? It's a different, I don't know what it is now. But anyway, I wanted to say that. So like, you know, people are so quick to say, oh, how did, you know, why did you go to force so quick? Like, or why do you have this many use of force reports? Because not on top of that, I was very proactive. So being very proactive, you know, certainly I have an argument also on proactivity versus reactivity and why I think being proactive is so much more a controlled environment than being reactive, right? Like, you're almost creating the environment when you're proactive for the most part, right? You're stopping a car, you're in control. You're running up on people, you're jumping out, you're in control. Where we see a lot of cops getting killed in these domestic violence situations, you're responding to something. So guys are like, well, I don't need this kind of training, da, da, da. You're the lazy guys, the ones who aren't motivated. They're the ones who are significantly more susceptible in my thoughts. And I don't know if there's factual data to back it up, that you're insane for thinking you don't need this stuff. And I just want to say this. There are, when you talked about having a expandable baton, and I don't want to name any brands because I was already approached by a brand and basically like silent threatened for, and my response was, look at the comments. I put these things up. Look at the comments. I will open my mouth and you guys should do something about it. That's exactly what I wrote back. If you know that there are 800 comments solidifying what I'm saying, don't you say to yourself, something's wrong. How do you comfortably hand police officers this tool and say, this is effective, it's working? Nobody's using it. So if it is effective, figure out how to teach these guys and girls how to make it effective. But anyway, you know, we talked about that tool being implemented as a crowd control tool. I would certainly think that you'd be absolutely out of your mind to take out a collapsible baton and try to take a crowd control situation under control. I would think you would need a much larger stick at a very primitive sense. Well, that's, and maybe even a shield.
Good teams are issued shields and real sticks, not collapsible batons. Mm-hmm. I've used my collapsible baton twice on duty, and both times I had to be issued a new one because I bent it and I couldn't close it. And both times it eventually worked. The reason that I don't use it more is it doesn't offer control. It's like me engaging in a fist fight with the guy. Let's say I have good boxing and I'm just going to keep smacking this guy and allow him to stay in the fight. Even if I'm winning those exchanges, that's not productive for me, because my primary goal when I go hands-on with you is to control you. a hit with an object does not give me control of you. And a lot of these guys will say, well, it's the way you use it. And if you used it better, you would hit them once and they'd be done. And then, you know, I might get that one shot, but I've been around long enough, fighting other humans long enough, that if you're hitting guys once and they're done, you're not fighting the right humans. There's a lot of guys who will eat that and they'll keep fighting. And so my argument is, A, it's severely restricted on when I can do it, because I've got to be clearly with the subject in assaultive behavior showing intent to do harm for me to hit them with the stick and for it to even get blessed by my agency. I got to be absolutely rock solid on the fact this guy is trying to hurt me. That's number one. And then number two is, even if I hit him, it doesn't allow me to control him. And ultimately what I'm trying to do with a resistive subject is gain physical control that leads me to handcuffing. If I hit him with the baton, and even if it hurts, but he doesn't stop fighting, and now I got to hit him again, and now I got to hit him again, I'm allowing this fight to continue to go. And the longer I allow it to go, the more he may get a shot in on me as well. And to your point, second place could mean death. It could mean disability. It could mean a dramatic turn in this fight. Second place is not a thing for me at work. So I'm not willing to have exchanges and have tactics that lead to me hitting him and him trying to hit me back, me hitting him and him trying to hit me back. Eventually, to gain control, I'm going to have to put that thing somewhere. Let's say he starts to comply. I got to put that thing away. And in the time I put it away, maybe he goes, okay, well, now we'll fight again because I'm not being controlled. So putting that thing in my hands is, even the baton guys, they'll go crazy over this. And they're probably going to get mad at me because they all try to get me to do stuff with them. And it's like, oh, you could use a baton for a takedown. You can use it for control to get his arm behind his back. Yeah, and I could also introduce a baton to him and now he gets armed with it. Now
I got to shoot him
because he's got my baton and I'm even okay with that because he's still choosing to take my baton and try to batter me with it. But what I'm not okay with is my very tactic put me in danger of being battered with my stuff. That I have a problem with. He can quit anytime he wants. I don't say that I created the shooting, but there will be people who say that, and some of them will be in your agency. So you're going to have to cross that bridge on how he got a hold of your crap and why you shot him with him with your crap in his hands. That is going to be a legitimate problem you're going to have to overcome if you end up dumping this guy. Chad's feeling is it's still that guy's fault, but it's still a faulty tactic if it exposes me to a life-threatening risk. If on the back end of my baton deployment, I'm shooting him, it's because that deployment led to me being under such an elevated risk that I had to engage him with gunfire. Well, I know what I could do. I could just keep that thing in its sheath, close the distance, work to an angle, snap him down, get a top position, and see if he wants to fight now from bottom position on the ground. Mm-hmm. And I can strike downward if we want to get in a fist fight now. I tell guys all the time, they'll say, well, Chad, he could hit you here while you're close to him with a knee on top of him and he's belly up. And I'll say, okay, well, let's put gloves on. Well, he could hit you in the balls. Okay. You can have no gloves on. I'll put gloves on to try to not break you. And let's have a fist fight with me kneeling on your chest, me punching down and you punching up. Let's see how long you want to exchange. Because I'll do it with everybody in the room. 40 guys could be in the room. I get to be the guy on top punching down. Okay. Let's have a fist fight. Mm-hmm. I'll fight everybody in the room one after another with no rest, and I'll beat all of you, and I'll fight you until you don't want to fight anymore. Position wins the day, not a baton. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about the touchstone with the taser, and we both acknowledge I'm on board with you. The taser is a good tool. It gets a bad name because it doesn't work some of the time. Well, nothing works all the time.
Even the dogs don't work every single time.
Shoot, the survival rate for handgun wounds in America is over 70%. Over 70% of the people you shoot with a handgun don't die. That's good news and bad news. If I get shot with a handgun and I'm not unconscious, I should be able to keep fighting, stay in the fight. The bad news is I could shoot someone with a handgun. Now, it might change his behavior, which is success, and he may become compliant, but he could still fight if he had it in him. He just says, okay, I don't have it in me anymore. I'm done with this.
You ever see the video of this, like, it was like in Nepal or something where they shoot that MMA fighter? Like, I mean, they hit him like 18 times and he's still fighting him.
Yeah.
I mean, they were hitting him with, like, you know, these guys are like clearly a third world country, the most untrained cops ever in the history. Like, they're all like these little dudes in these little beige uniforms, and they just have, they got a 38 special. It looks like they got it from the Civil War out, you know, and just like a, like, you know, like a detective special from the NYPD.
The beast get, for that guy.
Have you seen that video?
You know, I don't remember that one.
It's an old one.
But even if you study the Miami FBI shootout, where those guys were committed adversaries, and they took lethal rounds early in that shootout, and they kept fighting back, and they killed a couple agents and then badly maimed a few others. Those guys just kept fighting. They got shot repeatedly in that event, and they just kept fighting until they couldn't fight anymore. So nothing works all the time. So, like, I've got a guy, I've got good position on him, and he won't comply with me. And so I decide to strip off the taser cartridge and try to use pain, in essence, to make him comply. Well, he's already fighting. He's high on adrenaline minimum, dopamine. He probably has dope on board. He's committed to not going back to jail. That little taser drive stun is probably going to piss him off. And then I got to put that thing away to try to get control of him again. I'm not saying never do it. I'm just saying be intelligent. Sometimes we don't get the compliance we want right away. We're in a decent position. Just stay there and wear the guy out. Talk to him. Start to work his arms out. Stay calm. We teach trained approaches to extract arms from underneath people. But it can be done and done well. And I don't want a free-for-all. All of my defensive tactics is to try to give you a skill set, if you trained with me, where you're going to take those natural gifts you already have. You've got the right attitude. You've got the right ability. And you have good experience. You don't need to train with me. You are successful in the job. But I would take a guy like you and make you sharper, to where you're dominating dudes so severely that most of the time they're just breaking and they're not getting hurt. And they're saying, okay, I'll cuff up. Now, you will have those committed dogs, and those are the guys we're really training for. And those guys, I might need to actually use an application of force to overcome their resistance because they won't stop. But I put myself in positions where I can do that, and it's very effective. And that's what we really focus on with our DTs. To do that, going back to our original statement, I mean, you should be training in an academy. Instead of doing crazy exercises and hitting bags and stuff, they should be controlled using a system like PJJ, what we run, that incorporates wrestling, striking, jiu-jitsu type positional holds that lead to handcuffing or custody. And they should be doing that every day for their physical conditioning. It'll gas you. Because they need to get ready for a physical struggle, not a one-time bench press, not a marathon, not a... Half the time guys gas out in a real fight is because it's emotional to them. We've got to get it unemotional.
You know, it's so funny. I always tell people, I asked the guy who ran an academy one time I was there. I said, I guess you guys are out there jogging and doing wind sprints. Can you tell me why you guys are doing that? He said, well, when they leave here, if they're in a foot pursuit, they're going to be prepared. I go, I just want you to know that probably in my career of 14 years, I was probably in foot pursuits 5 to 10 times. Secondly, half these guys are going to midnights and they're going to be living on monsters and diner food. So they're going to get fat right away. One thing I could tell you is that sometimes you look at some of these trained fighters and they're not the peak of physical fitness. As far as the eye can see, you'll see these guys get into the ring or the octagon and they've got bellies. I said, what that tells me is they have really understood a set of skills. And I don't know what their body's doing. I'm not an expert on that. But if Butterbean can become a world champion, I would argue that he probably can't win in a foot pursuit, but in a hand-to-hand combat that you're preparing for, which is mostly what we're going to run into, why would you not think more of that and less of that? You're going for the what-ifs and just ignoring the probablys.
To your point, you're exactly right. And by the way, making them grapple each other for 45 minutes is better than any slow jog.
That's fucking brutal.
Because it's going to give them the cardio that running would give them. It'll give it to them, but it's also going to prepare them for what it feels like to be pushed and to push back and to keep my composure and continue to think and not be mad that I'm putting my hands on somebody. As a cop, we both know, you and I know, the only articulable emotion that will justify use of force is a reasonable fear of the consequences of your inaction. So irritation won't justify physical force. Anger won't justify physical force. He popped off at me won't justify physical force. The only thing that will justify physical force on the back end of your exchange with your bad guy is, did you have a reasonable fear and not wet my pants fear, not I'm afraid of clowns or I'm afraid of heights, not an irrational fear, but a reasonable, rational fear of the consequences of you not physically intervening. That's really what the fear is when we talk about I was in fear for my life. Civilians misunderstand this all the time. You mentioned some civilians might listen to your podcast. You'll see a cop, hey, I shot this person because I was in fear for my life. And it turns out the person was pointing a fake gun at them. And then you'll see a bunch of civilians say, well, this cop's so scared, he shouldn't be a cop. He's just shooting because he's scared. They don't understand there's a court requirement, a legal requirement, if I choose to use force on another human, that I'm using that force based on the fear of me not responding to whatever they're doing. That's the fear. It's a rational, reasonable fear that if I don't act, this bad thing's going to happen. It doesn't have to be happening. Some people say, well, he didn't shoot yet. Well, he doesn't have to. He just has to convince me he's going to. Well, he didn't punch you yet, officer. Nobody clenched his jaw. He changed his stance. He started to pull his hand back. His hand was clenched in a fist. And I preemptively hit him and then took him to the ground and controlled him and put cuffs on him. Oh, that guy never actually swung at you. No, but he said he was going to swing at me in 10 different ways. And I articulate them here, 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 here. And so it doesn't even have to happen. I just have to reasonably believe or fear that it's going to happen. And if I do not respond with force, that this articulable injury or threat or harm is going to come to me or somebody else. And that can vary on the spectrum from, I'm just going to get an owie or get punched to, okay, well now he's trying to stab or shoot me or disarm me. And if he disarms me, he's going to reasonably use that against me. And so then my response grows force option wise.
I have one more thing I want to say, then I have a final question for you, which is a good question. First of all, I want to make a statement. And again, not factually based, but just on the things that I see and I hear. I've gone to 3 police academies. I have actually friends of mine and all sorts of people who are in academies. Typically, the injuries we see from recruits, because the first thing people say is, well, you're going to get injured doing this Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Well, that's interesting because the only time I've ever seen people get injured in academies and have to get recycled is typically in running, blown out knees, things typically in the legs. Usually isn't things sustained from defensive tactics. And people would say, well, there's this one time. I get it. We're very aware of the situations that have occurred that were unfortunate at times. Not saying that we're talking about probability versus possibility. And if we're measuring what's important, and I said to somebody one time, you know, I find it comical that these chiefs of police are reluctant to send people to Brazilian jiu-jitsu training or some kind of PJJ, whatever you want to call it. Yet they're willing to put their officers at risk in a non-controlled environment, but not in a controlled environment, and reduce the likelihood of actual litigation and them using force improperly. It is wild to me. And I get where the concern comes from. There's compassion about that because you need bodies on the road, but you are setting yourselves up for extreme failure and the best case scenario, some real exposure for litigation and big numbers, because you're going to, I tell people this all the time, the first thing these defense attorneys are going to do, or so these plaintiff's attorneys are going to say, is show me your training records. Show me your training records. What are you guys doing? So that's the lead into understanding all the issues that we have in law enforcement time between not having time to train and I mean that the agency's not giving you time off. There's no training budget, right? There's a lot of different reasons why people would not have the ability to attend training or at least feel like they didn't. What can people do, namely police officers, now to improve themselves in this area? Obviously, one of those things is hire you guys as a consulting firm. But if that's not an option, what else can they do?
I can't tell you how much I've learned from watching what you put out for free. There's a lot of us that put out free content constantly, and to include good training methodology, good best practices, all those things. So if you can't find anything nowadays online for free, you're just not making an effort. You're not trying. So that's number one. Number two is, when I was a young officer, I realized I had to train, and I realized my department wasn't going to give me the training, and there wasn't a budget, to your point. And as you know, I have a lot of children. I've been married over 30 years, and I have 8 children. And I've never been a cop where I didn't have multiple kids at home in the house. At one point, as a cop, I had 8 kids in my house. I had 3 daughters, 5 sons, in addition to my wife, very large family. And so how am I going to find the time or the energy or the money to train? What my wife and I settled on is we had a budget that the family has to have their needs met first. But then I would work overtime, and a portion of that overtime would support family goals. But I could also put a certain amount of money into a training fund. And so I could dedicate an overtime shift a month to training. And I could save that money and look at classes like maybe something you would offer, for example, that I might want to attend. And I would circle those dates and those times, and I would save up, and I'd work overtime. And my wife and I agreed on a budget. And I also, out of that budget, paid my gym dues. So instead of having a 24-hour fitness membership or a Gold's Gym membership, which I had before I was a cop, I switched that to a MMA Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu gym membership. And I would go to those classes when I could. And then I'd work an overtime shift a month to go seek out training on either use of force, case law, physical DT crap, whatever, a BJJ seminar that was really good, training company I wanted to go to. So it took some coordination and some effort from Chad for me to do that. Now, in recent years, I've become a more and more vocal, outspoken critic of police departments and their lack of investment in their officers, and then their critical review of officers after the fact, to your point. Since George Floyd, I've seen a huge increase in chiefs who talk to me about training and about budgeting for training. It's night and day. I get communication with chiefs. I never got communication with chiefs before unless somebody kind of knew me and they kind of introduced. I have far more communication. So we're going in the right direction. We're just not there yet. To kind of close off this thought or this segment is what I would say to the individual officer is A, you know, look for stuff online that's free. B, you've got to set aside time and you got to schedule it to make yourself better. You got to invest in yourself. I don't care what your department does. And then C, make a reasonable plan that you can raise funds to invest in yourself, not only with time and effort, but also monetarily to go seek training from somebody like you, who's a subject matter expert who can bring a lot to the table. And in a very condensed time, I can gain a lot of knowledge and then use that and build on that in the future, apply it on calls, things like that. To kind of bring this home, I heard this articulated a different way, but I apply it to training. And that is the idea of choosing your heart. In life, there's two things that are true. You have agency. You can choose how much you're going to work or not work. You can choose how much you're going to invest in yourself or not invest in yourself. You have choice. That's number one. Number two is everything's hard. There's no easy choices. And that's by design, I believe. My personal belief is I believe that's from God. But whether you believe there's a God or not, you have to admit that everyone has freedom of choice, everyone, and everyone has hard choices. There's no easy choices. When we put this in a life context, being financially sound is hard. It takes discipline. I can't just buy whatever I want. I've got to save my money. I can't just run up credit cards. Well, being broke is hard. Being sound is hard. Being broke is hard. I got to choose my heart. There's not an easy choice. Being physically fit is hard. I've actually got to put effort in several times a week. I have to watch what I eat. Being physically fit is hard. Being physically unfit is hard. Now I'm unhealthy. Now I start to sleep bad. Now everything hurts. I get injured more often. So it's not an easy. I don't get to choose, okay, well, I'll just be kind of fit and do no effort. You're either working to be fit You're either killing yourself in the gym or you're killing yourself on the couch, but you're killing yourself. And so everything's hard. Being divorced is hard. Being married is hard. You just have to choose your heart. And I'm not saying guys who have gotten divorced, maybe that was a hard choice. This person's so toxic, I got to get away from them. But it's always a hard choice. There's no easy choice in life. Finding time to train is hard. Being in a backyard at 3 a.m. by yourself at the end of a foot pursuit and a fight with a guy and not having training is hard. You got to choose your heart. Investing in training prior to a critical event is hard. You got to invest time and money. Getting into a critical event with no investment personally is hard. And you might pay a huge price because you didn't pay up front. Everything has a price. You have agency and you have the ability to choose. And what I say is choose your heart. Now, once I start choosing my heart, I can be accountable for Chad because I'm choosing. So I can go and I teach my kids this lesson. I say, there's no easy. It's only hard, but choose your heart and then own it and then be accountable to it. And now you can control it. You can go, yeah, this was hard, but I chose it. So that's kind of how I address those cops who are struggling with, man, it's hard for me to train. I get it. It is. So choose your heart. Don't be trained and see how that works out for you. Or go put the training in and see how that works out.
I will finish with this. I had a thought, and I say this in class often, you know, guys, I'm not on the job anymore. The last thing in the world that Dennis Bonino wants is a fight. If you want to fight me, you better find me first. Cause the minute you start coming after me, unless you're going to hurt me and it's imminent or you go anywhere near my family, I'll fucking kill you. But outside of that, you're at a bar, you drank too much. I'm gonzo, right? I'm not here. Yeah. I am gone. You could be the toughest dude you want to be. I am literally out of here. With that being said, if I was active in law enforcement now, with the amount of Brazilian jiu-jitsu dojos, essentially, or mixed martial arts gyms that are available, I mean, it's almost like a stone's throw away to any direction you want to toss a rock where people are rolling around on mats. When there's an effort, you'll find the way. But to say that there's not the ability to go and do this anywhere, you're only fooling yourself. I mean, I'll be honest with you. Remember this 20 years ago, people don't forget. I say this in class. UFC was illegal. Like, remember? Yes. Like, that's why they came to Vegas. You couldn't go and fight people. It was illegal.
So my message for coppers to your point is jiu-jitsu's only been in America for 40 years. It's only been in competition where people watched it when it was illegal for 25 years. It's only been on ESPN for 3-4 years. Where now it's mainstream, it's regulated, all that. It's never going away. The reason we didn't already do it is it wasn't here. There are now cops. We're finally getting chiefs who have done jiu-jitsu. And jiu-jitsu and MMA, the tenets are gain control and dominant positioning, then finish your opponent. Well, that goes right into policing. Gain control, dominant position, and then finish with handcuffing. So it fits cop stuff. It's never going away. It's only going to grow. You might as well embrace it if you're a cop because it actually works for the job. I have to tweak it. I have to change my strategies and what I'm trying to achieve. In a match, I might be trying to get you to tap. I'm not trying to get you to tap. I'm trying to get you in handcuffs. So I've got to use my jiu-jitsu and my wrestling to handcuff you. But if I wasn't trying to handcuff you, I would use it to choke you or to leg lock you or to arm lock you. So it's important that the jiu-jitsu guys who come into law enforcement realize the difference. But once you realize the difference, it's never going away, Dennis. These cops should just embrace it because it works for the job. And especially with what civilians expect. Civilians expect to watch a controlled, trained application of force that's effective. And when you do crazy, they lose confidence in you. They don't even know why it's wrong. They just go, oh, that's wrong. Cop hit him 15 times. Well, if you hit a dude 15 times, he's not asleep. You suck at punching. You need training, in my mind. But you're going to lose all confidence from people watching you because you're not effective. When you are ineffective in your application of force, people think it's excessive. They're watching ineffective force. They think they're watching excessive force. And to them, they don't care. And even police administrators will do the same thing. They'll watch you do crazy nonsense that doesn't work, and they'll lose all confidence in you. Oh, we never trained you to do that. We never had a scenario where the guy didn't just fall down when you hit him once in the leg with your baton. You must have hit him wrong. In training, they fall down every time. No, the reality is they don't fall down every time.
Hey, that wasn't a green zone. That was a red zone, right? That was exactly a yellow zone.
We don't train realistically. And that's the other good point about MMA and Jits is you can train as long as you're controlling what you're doing to each other and you're controlling pace. You can train fairly live and have little to no injury. Guys do it all day, every day in gyms across this nation. Little kids do it. Housewives do it. So it's never going away. It was a great comment by you. I can't build on it more because I've been in the game since 98. I've seen what we did in 98. And I know what we're going to do in 2028. And it's going to be more towards jiu-jitsu and MMA than ever. We're going away from Krav Madness. We're going away from pressure point. We're going away from going to your tool belt. All that stuff's departments are going away from it.
And as they should.
As they should. You ought to be good right here first and right here. You ought to have knowledge and an ability to talk to people. These come next. This, my belt, is so restricted, I'm almost never going to use it.
This has been another great episode, and it's always a pleasure to have you, and you are a profound guest here on our podcast, and it's always a pleasure, and we'll do this again in the future, no doubt about it. What a great episode. I think people really got a lot out of it. So, Chad, on behalf of everybody, please thank you, but also tell us where they can find you and your company.
So you can find us online at C4CPJJ or at pfctraining.com, C4CPJJ.com or pfctraining.com. You can find me online on Instagram at C4C Operator or C4CPJJ. And then you can find me on Facebook, Chad Lyman, if you Google me there, and also on YouTube. Those are the primary ways. I'm super responsive. If you follow me and hit me up on Instagram, like DM, direct message me, I'll get back to you, including calling you if you have a use of force question or a training question. I'm more than willing to help out. And of course, we do travel and do mobile classes, or you can come to Vegas. But you don't have to do a class with me to build that relationship. If you're a cop out there, even a civilian, you have a use of force question or a training question, feel free to hit me up. I'll be sure to respond back.
You are the man, Chad Lyman.
Yeah, you are. Thanks, Dennis.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.